Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books in History. My guest today is J. Douglas Smith. We'll be talking about his new book, On Democracy's Doorstep, the inside story of how the Supreme Court brought one person, one vote to the United States. Doug, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
It's a very, very interesting book, very, very interesting topic. I'm glad that you decided to join us. Why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write it?
Sure. So I did my doctoral training at the University of Virginia, and I was really immersed primarily in the program in Southern history, and my interests were really in Southern history, race, and politics. And interesting enough, so my dissertation, which became my first book, really focused on kind of Jim Crow Virginia and through the mid-20th century, what I like to think of as the last couple generations of Jim Crow, sort of World War I up through the Brown decision. And in doing that work, I discovered that in 1956, when the Virginia legislature passed a series of laws that came to be known as the Massive Resistance Laws, which said that Virginia would close its public schools rather than allow even token integration, there was a Washington newspaper man by the name of Benjamin Muse at the time who pointed out that the key measure that led to the Massive Resistance Laws passed the Virginia Senate by a fairly narrow margin of 21-17, and the 17 senators who opposed closing the schools, who were not necessarily in favor of integration, but they just thought that the Supreme Court had spoken and that further resistance was futile. But those 17 actually represented more Virginians than did the 21 who supported massive resistance. And so I entered the topic of malapportionment through this venue, really, and sort of started to think about, you know, white supremacy and Jim Crow really as a byproduct of minority rule, where you have a minority of the state's residents imposing these laws. And so as I began to think about a second book, I wanted to move beyond state study. And I thought what this was going to be was a regional study of sort of looking broadly at the South and ways in which malapportionment had been a key component of white supremacy and Jim Crow. And given that a lot of the early malapportionment cases come out of the South, that seemed to be where I was headed. But it didn't take me very long to figure out that I had sort of stumbled into what was very much a national topic. And while, yes, the South was dependent on malapportionment to perpetuate Jim Crow, it turns out that in, you know, almost every state in the nation, often for very different reasons, with very different political climates, malapportionment was thriving. So it was a real education for me. It was exciting to find out that I actually had stumbled onto a truly national topic, but also somewhat daunting and sort of trying to figure out how to tell a national story without getting bogged down into, you know, 50 micro studies of individual states. So.
Yeah. Well, it is surprising when you see the extent of it. I mean, we'll talk about some of these statistics here. They really are staggering. But it's surprising how little attention this, I mean, it's not as though historians aren't aware of this, right? But it doesn't quite have the sort of central headline role that maybe it ought to have.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, in the 1960s, when the Supreme Court finally took up the cases, and it was in 1964 that the court handed down the final decisions, obviously, there are a lot of other things made for headlines that were going on in the 1960s, the civil rights movement, then the Vietnam War, event after event that really were in many ways made for television and which provided much better news, whereas malapportionment can easily get bogged down in statistics and you know, what percentage of the people are electing what percent of the legislature and stuff that can be fairly dry. Until you realize just how important it is, I think, in the ways in which it was actually provided for essentially a system of minority rule throughout the United States, where rural areas and small towns were vastly overrepresented in state legislatures and in Congress.
Well, it becomes this really important sort of framework in which to understand these policy outcomes during this period, right? It was surprising to me that even the advocates in your story, the people that are pushing for equal representation, are, you know, I don't know, somewhat at ease, or, you know, they're surprised at how far the Warren Court goes in their decisions, right? So even the people that are out in front on this issue are jaded, or this is a question to you, but.
Well, yes, no, I think that's absolutely right. And part of it, I think, to understand sort of the, to kind of provide the, try to quickly to try to provide the basic framework is that, you know, throughout the first half or two thirds of the 20th century, as the United States is urbanizing, and almost, you know, not in every state, but in most parts of the country, the urban population is growing. And what happens in many of these states is that as the urban populations grow, there's no reapportionment. And so with increased urbanization, you have greater and greater malapportionment. A perfect example is California, where, you know, when California became a state in 1850, it has a state constitution which says that both branches of the legislature will be based on population. And that was all fine and well throughout the 19th century when San Francisco remained a lot larger than Los Angeles. But then by the early 20th century, as L.A. was growing and Southern California was growing by leaps and bounds, folks in the Bay Area and in Northern California said, well, hang on a second, we're in danger of losing control of the legislature. And so they passed a referendum in 1926, which essentially said that no state senator could represent more than one county, and no state senator could represent more than three counties, and no county could have more than one state senator. So that leaves me with a situation by 1960 where Los Angeles County, which had by then grown to over 6 million people, has one state senator, as do if you take three counties on the eastern side of the Sierra, which is a very rural area, 14,000 people, the same amount of representation in the state legislature. So you end up with a situation where you have one branch of the legislature with, you know, representing roughly 12% of the population. And obviously the implications for public policy are staggering. It means, you know, any single piece of legislation now has to, you know, can essentially be vetoed by the representatives of a small number of the populace. Now, as states urbanize, and you see this especially in states like California or Illinois, New York, Pennsylvania, as the urban populations grow, you do have municipal officials who increasingly are agitated because the legislatures, which are rural dominated, are not returning much money to the cities for schools, for highway improvements, for a lot of things that are concern. And so there's this growing sense that the urban areas are providing the tax base and getting very little in return from the legislatures. And so in the wake of World War II, you have this real, you know, as with continued population growth, this really comes to a head, if you will. And sort of in direct response to your initial question is that the situation was so bad in so many states that I think a lot of advocates of reapportionment simply were hoping that they could at least have one branch of the legislature based on population. They weren't so much pushing for both because, after all, we do have the federal model provided one option, and that seemed to make sense to people, that if the federal Congress, you have a Senate based on geography, a population, a House based on population, then why shouldn't the states have a similar model? And so that, I think, for a lot of the early proponents, that was really as much as they were hoping for, that they would have a legislature of that sort. Of course, the problem with that is that you can still have, you know, one branch of the legislature can essentially veto any piece of legislation.
Right. It means, you know, you sort of end up asking yourself, well, how much of the government is actually represented by population? I mean, how much of the democracy is this? You know, because you have bicameral legislature, sure, but if a minority has control of one house and they're co-equal, right? And the United States is an outlier in this internationally. They essentially have veto power.
Absolutely, and of course, one of the fascinating aspects of this, we'll probably get into more later, is that after the Supreme Court decisions come down, and then there's this effort to actually overturn them, the opponents of the court decision, so the folks who had benefited most from malapportionment, began this sort of campaign, this sort of series of scare tactics, one of which is that, oh, well, next thing you know, the Supreme Court's going to invalidate the federal Congress, which was never contemplated. But they actually, you know, one of my favorite images from all of this was a map that was drawn of the United States, of what the United States Senate would look like if it was based on population rather than, you know, by state. And so, you know, California would have had something like 9 state senators along with Nevada. And, you know, and so there was that fear that if you took this to the extreme, of course, the Supreme Court had said from the beginning, look, the compromise, the original Constitution was specifically drawn up, and no one's even contemplating touching that.
So. Yeah, well, Ezra Klein had something on his new website the other day about, the majority of the population by something like 20 million had voted Democratic in the last 3 cycles,
right?
But they had, you know, 10 or 15 fewer senators.
Right.
And the, you know, and the scholars who have looked at this at the federal level have found, you know, that the same thing was happening as on the state level, that these small states repeatedly take far more than their proportionate level of revenue from the big states, which generate most of the wealth, and yet veto
Right.
constantly what the majority of the population is asking for. So you know, it's not an issue that's lost any saliency. So I like the way you begin the book. The book is about the Warren Court and its decisions and how we how this changes. And you lay out in the introduction that you begin with this lovely little story where there's a press conference in 1968. The occasion is Chief Justice Earl Warren's retirement. And these journalists are asking him what his most important decision is, and this is, you know, Earl Warren, you know, whose court had laid down Brown v. Board of Ed, striking down segregation in schools, Gideon v. Wainwright, giving criminal defendants a right to legal representation, Miranda, Arizona, protecting suspects from entrapment. So there's any number of major cases for which he's well known. Arguably, he's still not the court is still not best remembered for the cases that you're discussing, but he doesn't, you know, skip a beat. He says, absolutely, it's Baker Carr, Reynolds Sims, and these other cases, which enshrine the concept of one person, one vote at the state level.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And he was very consistent at that beginning, you know, as you said, with the press conference when he initially announced his retirement all the way up, you know, through his death when in 1974, whenever he was asked about this, he felt that in terms of that as important as the segregation decisions were, that the reapportionment decisions affected the American system of democracy more thoroughly and completely, and you know, every single individual was affected by those decisions, and that he sort of felt in terms of what those decisions meant in terms of the importance of each individual's vote, everybody's participation, that there was no other decision that so thoroughly and fundamentally addressed the American system of democracy.
You know that there had been various efforts to challenge what was called malapportionment in the post-World War II era, but legislatures essentially continued to act with impunity because the courts always refused to intervene, constantly sort of saying that malapportionment, yes, it violated state constitutional requirements often, but the courts would claim that they couldn't or that they wouldn't get involved because districting was a privilege of the legislative branch, and under separation of powers, it was, in Felix Frankfurter's famous words, a political thicket into which the court was not jurisdictionally allowed to enter. And so they refused later cases too, until Baker Carr. So maybe you should just, what's different about Baker Carr, and how do we get to that decision?
Sure, that's a great question, and just to back up a little bit, so you referred to, you know, Felix Frankfurter's opinion in Colgrove versus Green, which was actually a case that challenged malapportionment of congressional districts in Illinois right around World War II. The decision was handed down in 1946, and that's when, you know, Frankfurter had been the most strident advocate of the federal courts not getting involved. As you said, state courts simply wouldn't get involved. They said, well, yes, there's a problem here, but the legislature can only fix it. Federal courts sort of said, this is for the states. Frankfurter in particular thought, we have to stay out of this. I think what happens is that throughout the 1950s, and Baker v. Carr comes out of Tennessee, and it's important to understand sort of what was happening in Tennessee is that, you know, the rural areas, like, I'm sorry, the urban areas like Memphis and Nashville and Chattanooga as well, grew and grew and grew and felt like they were getting less and less a share of resources and were having more and more problems meeting their needs. And so you have this actual very interesting coalition of kind of old line Memphis Democrats and East Tennessee Republicans come together along with groups like the League of Women Voters to begin really pressing for reapportionment. The legislature continues to refuse. There's an effort in the mid 1950s that gets goes to court and then gets thrown out for the usual reasons. And to be perfectly honest, what in terms of the Supreme Court, what's different about Baker v. Carr, in part you have a changing and evolving Supreme Court. That certainly makes a difference. And so the first hint that the Supreme Court might be willing to change its mind actually comes in 1958. There was a challenge to Georgia's county unit system. Georgia had a unique system in which statewide officials were elected based on each county was assigned a certain number of units. So if you won the county vote, you got X number of units, and that allowed, again, the rural areas to have a way disproportionate role in the system. So that had been challenged several times and thrown out. And in 1958, there were actually four justices. Once William Brennan came onto the court, Earl Warren came under the court and sort of joined William O. Douglas and Hugo Black, you all of a sudden had four justices instead of just Black and Douglas, who began to sort of see that there were potentially equal protection violations with the county unit system, with malapportionment. And so even though this case didn't go anywhere in 1958, that was the first sign that there was increased interest amongst the Supreme Court. And this is all, no one knew this, this is all behind the scenes, sort of there was speculation. Baker v. Carr gets refiled or gets filed in Tennessee in 1959, a year later. And finally, again, the Tennessee court, the district court, federal district court that hears it in Tennessee, acknowledges the problems, even calls malapportionment an evil, says that it's such the problems are so severe. But again, says the Supreme Court has said that we can't enter the political thicket. We don't have jurisdiction here. And so in early 1960, the Tennessee lawyers for the Tennessee plaintiffs appeal to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court does an interesting thing. They hold the case. They also had before them Gamillion versus Lightfoot, the racial gerrymandering case out of Alabama. And they actually waited until they handed down their decision in Gamillion, where they unanimously said that racial gerrymandering was unconstitutional. And then a week later, they announced that they were going to accept jurisdiction in Baker v. Carr. And at the time, you know, it requires four votes amongst the Supreme Court to grant certiorari in a case. Of course, you need five to carry the day in the final disposition. So there were four justices, not five, who agreed to hear the case. And Baker v. Carr is quite interesting in that it's one of the few cases that was argued not once but twice. So it was argued before the Supreme Court initially in April of 1961. So it was actually the Eisenhower administration, it was the tail end of the Eisenhower administration when the court first agreed to hear Baker. And actually the Lee Rankin, who was the Solicitor General at the end of the Eisenhower administration, he and the Attorney General, William Rogers, agreed that the Eisenhower administration would support the Tennessee plaintiffs. So this is actually, I think, a really interesting point about this is that it wasn't just, you know, the Kennedy administration that came into office a few weeks later, but the actual previous Eisenhower administration had also seen the need to be so great for real reform so you had both the Eisenhower administration and the Kennedy administration firmly behind Baker v. Carr.
Now, yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. One of the more interesting things struck me is that, you know, Eisenhower comes, this, you know, as you said, malapportionment becomes, you know, it's a transcontinental thing. We find it everywhere. But typically, and in the North, as you, or in the South, as you say, it strengthens the power of these, you know, white sort of supremacist minority. I mean, tremendous amount of disenfranchisement of whites and blacks in the South, and goes to the Democratic Party, which is the only party that's basically operating in the South after the Civil War up until the 70s or 60s. But in the North, malapportionment typically helped the Republican Party. I mean, you have this sort of weird paradox where you have these big cities, these big population centers that are Democratic, and yet the legislature is dominated by the GOP up until 70s for many of these states. And yet Eisenhower comes in right away in 1953, right? And puts into place the Katzenbach Commission, which ends up generating support, right, for reform on this issue.
Right, the Kestenbaum Commission. Yes, yes, it was a commission that was appointed by Eisenhower. It had a combination of sort of both political figures and also some industrialists and business leaders, and they issued a report. It was about, and one of the things they found was that that malapportionment needed to be fixed. And one of the issues that one of the things that they raised is they said, look, one of the reasons that there's so many cities and urban groups going to the federal government for help is because the states have been so bad at addressing some of these issues, and that in fact, if we reapportion the state legislatures and the state legislatures begin to pay a little bit more attention to some of the urban issues, that in fact there will be less need for the federal government to actually step in and provide certain housing and welfare and educational assistance and those sorts of things. So yes, this was I think part of a part of a broader good government, sort of more in the kind of the traditional progressive reform of having better government, and then also you also have, it was under the Eisenhower administration that the Justice Department, that you create, that you have the first Office of Civil Rights in the Justice Department. So, and they're intimately tied with this issue of malapportionment. As you go forward into the Kennedy administration, the Civil Rights Division plays a large role, in all of that, as well. So you do have this growing recognition that there are, that the system that has evolved is just bad on so many levels. While yes, maybe it promotes certain advantages for the Republicans in the North, the North and the Midwest, that the problems that it creates are even more important. And so you have this willingness to step in and do something about this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe we should throw out some statistics here. We've been talking about this, but just to sort of anchor some of the listeners, I'm looking at some of the figures here from your book. Congress decided not to reapportion for the first time in 1920 when the census revealed that the population was majority urban. At the time, that was considerably important to the farm bloc and the prohibitionists, and this is right around the time when we have this revival of the Ku Klux Klan around the issue of immigration, and they sealed the national borders. You write that a dozen states had apportionment based on population alone, but in Delaware and Mississippi, for example, there was no consideration given to population whatsoever in either house. Most states used the classical federal combination of land area and population, but like the House of Representatives, states guaranteed at least one representative per county, no matter how small. What was known as the silent gerrymander, or refusing to reapportion, every time there was a census taken. Oregon doesn't reapportion for a half century after 1907. Pennsylvania and Indiana don't do it for 30 to 40 years after 1920. Alabama and Tennessee don't do it for 60 years after the 20th century begins.
Right.
So we have a situation by the time that the Warren Court is looking to hear these issues. Vermont, you have districts where the smallest district is 38 people. The capital, Burlington, has 38,000, and they both have the same number of senators, right? New Jersey is represented by as few as and these are rough, I'd run into these figures out, but as few as 50 people or as many as, or I'm sorry, 50,000 or as many as 500,000.
Yeah.
Georgia, it's 15,000 to 500,000. Idaho, it's 1,000 to 100,000. You already cited California, but Michigan is maybe the most striking example where you have, you say that the Democrats would have needed at least 70% of the popular vote just to control one chamber.
Right.
Detroit alone has 45% of the population in 1930. By 1950, half the workforce in Michigan is unionized. And yet, with brief exceptions, the Michigan legislature is dominated by small and rural right. Republicans until the 1970s.
Right.
I hate to keep, I don't want to belabor the point, but I mean, just to continue a little and wrap this up, you said by 1962, only five states, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Oregon, West Virginia, Wisconsin, had apportioned districts so that majorities in both chambers represented at least 40% of the population. In 23 states, it was less than 30%, and 10 among those didn't even reach 20%. And because these state legislatures could control congressional districts, it also meant that you had, some of the, you note that some of the leading figures of the time, people like Sam Rayburn, right, who's famous as the longest running representative, came from, wins with fewer than 16,000 voters in 1958. At least eight of the 20 committee chairs come from similarly overrepresented districts, so that people like Wilbur Mills, right, the all-powerful head of Ways and Means, gatekeeper of social legislation in post-war America, also comes from this sort of rotten, this is rotten boroughs on a mass scale. So it really is, I mean, it really was sort of at a crisis level. And it's sort of, as you say, it's easy to sort of overlook when you consider all the other momentous things that are going on at that time. But it also ties into Jim Crow, and I imagine that's a big part of how it gets, how the momentum builds behind it.
Well, it is, and let me make one correction, because it was actually from what you're reading. One mistake that that I realized the day the book was published was that you refer to Burlington as which was way underrepresented. Burlington is not the capital of Vermont; it's actually Montpelier. And I realized that somehow I got through the editing, and the minute the book was published, literally on the day, I realized that the point there wasn't that it was the capital, but it was the largest city, of course, and so you had states like Vermont and Connecticut, which guaranteed every city or every town a member of the legislature, which is why you have such small districts there. But the question about, certainly Jim Crow was important. As I said at the outset, I sort of went into this thinking that this was all about Jim Crow. But as you've just, I think, ably summarized, it became quickly clear how much it was about so much more than Jim Crow. That yes, I mean, it's very clear that in these states where the Democrats are the party of in the South, that where they're committed to Jim Crow, and of course it's the counties with the highest percentage of African Americans who are almost all disfranchised, where you have even more malapportionment, because essentially you've got a very small number of whites in those counties who are really who have the political power, because malapportionment is based on the entire, the entire population of those Black Belt counties, but it's really only the whites within those already underrepresented areas that are being elected. And so it's sort of there's a double effect there in many regards. But as as those statistics, and I said at the outset, fortunately I didn't have to do any of the statistical work. There were political scientists who actually did all of did this work, and it was just my job to try to synthesize it in a way that sort of made sense and that presented the problem for what it was. But it is, I mean, it is absolutely staggering when you start to realize how to the extent to which people were underrepresented in the United States. And we had not that we're that we've solved all the problems now, and in many ways, and I think this book seems even more timely now than it did 10 years ago when I started it, in terms of some of the challenges that are facing us in elections and the whole issue of voting. But it goes on and on throughout the country, and the effect, the potential effect that this has, the malapportionment has on any piece of legislation, on any effort. When John F. Kennedy ran for president in 1960, he or one of his aides authored a piece that ran in the New York Times called "The Shame of the Cities," sorry, "The Shame of the States," which really sort of made this, highlighted this as a national issue, and one that, clearly urban voters were going to be central to Kennedy's campaign, and so that in many ways that helped elevate the issue to sort of a national discussion. At the same time, it was beginning to come to the, to reach the courts, and the courts were beginning to take a different look at it.
Yeah, well, I don't want to I want to get to the main story here, but just to follow up on what you were saying before, I mean, Ira Kass Nelson has this new book out about the New Deal, and remarks in the introduction that it's odd how in early literature on the New Deal, the South is sort of a side note almost, when malapportionment, among other things, was hugely important because the whole total population would be counted, even though, as you said, so many people were disenfranchised in the South. And so the South, while it has basically a minority of the population, essentially rules Congress. And everything has to pass through there. And so the New Deal is diluted, particularly when it comes to racial issues, because of this. And even though the population falls in the South, they retain that control into the Kennedy era. And so, we task Kennedy and these folks for not being able to do more, but in a sense, they're sort of handcuffed because we always forget that, Congress is what makes laws and not presidents. They're not kings. So it really is just a huge issue historically.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, just to cite one example from the South, Georgia had congressional districts where in South Georgia, which you had I think a district, where someone represented 150 or 200,000 people, and then around Atlanta, where by the 1960s many African Americans had settled, there was the congressman represented, I think it was either 500,000 or at one time as high as 800,000 people. So the disparity is enormous. And as you say, it's fine to blame the whether it's Roosevelt and the New Deal or Kennedy for what they weren't able to do, but there are realities here in terms of you need the votes in Congress, and if those votes aren't there, what can you do?
Well, okay. So let's get into the story of the court and how this plays out. There's some ironies in here. The chapter on the California in 48 notes that Earl Warren and Whitaker Baxter, which is a company you can tell us about, becomes very important to the fight later on, are in these early years on the same side of this representation debate.
Right.
So maybe you can talk about that and how that changes and
Sure.
about
Well,
this.
yeah, no. So Earl Warren, for those who don't know, until yesterday, when Jerry Brown was sworn into his fourth term as California's governor, Earl Warren was the only other person to have served, and still the only other person to have served three terms as governor of California. And he was incredibly popular, so much so that when he ran for re-election the second and the third time, I think both the Democrats made him their candidate as well. He was very successful governor of California, and as governor, he defended California's system of apportionment, which was essentially a version of the federal model. We had a lower assembly, that the assembly based on population, the state senate, as I pointed out, based on area, and in fairly extreme and extreme system. But it actually worked pretty well in California. So even unlike some of the other states where malapportionment led to all sorts of regressive legislation or absolute lack of progressive legislation, one of the ironies here is that you actually had a fairly malapportioned legislature passing a lot of legislation in the 1950s that helped support the growth of the state. And Warren, as governor, essentially thought that its system worked pretty well. He said later on, as chief justice, because his critics constantly brought this up and said what a hypocrite he was, he said, "You know what?" He said, "Looking at this from a political perspective as a governor, I saw it in one way. Later on, as a chief justice, I saw my responsibilities were no longer just to the state, but to the nation, and I came to see it in a different way. And I was wrong before." And he was very honest and open about it. He didn't hesitate for a second. He didn't try to make excuses or hem and haw. He just said he came to change his mind as he began to look at it not as a governor, but as a chief justice. So yes, there is, and then a lot of irony in that. And then you point out Whitaker and Baxter, who were one of the real revelations for me in writing this book. Probably known to very few people, but they were a husband and wife pair, a team who were often considered to be the first political campaign consultants in the United States, and they were actually business partners first, and then got married. And their relationship is quite fascinating. They came on the scene at a time when California had adopted the initiative in the referendum, and they were there at the right time. They were very good at their job. Their first campaign, they were actually hired. There was a ballot in the early 1930s, a ballot initiative in the early 1930s to create a publicly financed flood control system. And predictably, the large utility companies opposed it, and much to everyone's surprise, it actually passed. Whitaker and Baxter were able to, on that, in that particular case, they represented David against Goliath. They did such a good job that the utilities put them on retainer for life after that. So that was sort of the only time that they ever represented the smaller interest. And they went on, they essentially dominated California politics for about 30 years, both in terms of ballot initiatives and elections. They even worked for in Earl Warren's initial campaign for governor. They were his campaign consultants, but they actually had a falling out towards the very end of the election as Warren began to actually moderate his position on a number of things. Whitaker and Baxter they began to split to the point where they actually by the end of the campaign they weren't really speaking. But then as governor he had to they sort of. While Warren was governor, Whitaker and Baxter got their revenge when Warren proposed a system of statewide health insurance that he thought was necessary. And Whitaker and Baxter were hired by the California Medical Association to kill that. And as a result of their work there, they were then hired a couple years later by the American Medical Association to shoot down Harry Truman's plan for national health insurance. You know, what's that, 60 some years ago now, which, and of course, here with the debates over the Affordable Care Act, we're still fighting about.
Mm-hmm.
So they're deeply, I think, very important to the story, and they really began to run campaigns in a new way, and we're seeing them doing that. And so we can talk later about how they enter the story again, or their son, Whitaker's son, Baxter's stepson, how he kind of led the campaign to overturn the Supreme Court's reapportionment decisions later on.
Yeah, and what about these other folks on the court? I mean, obviously this is pivotal to the story. I mean, where do these, you know, when these cases start coming, bubbling up, who are the other figures and where are they, what's their position on this? How much of this is, I wonder how much of this is straight partisanship.
In terms of the justices?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so as I started to say earlier, so Baker's fascinating in that it's actually, oral arguments are held twice in Baker. The first time it comes up is in April of 1961, and you have, and the court is divided. From the initial hearing, you have Hugo Black and William O. Douglas, who are FDR New Deal appointees, Earl Warren and William Brennan, who are both Eisenhower appointees. Warren, of course, had been the Republican governor of California, the Republican nominee for vice president in 1948. You know, if Dewey had in fact defeated Truman, Earl Warren would have been vice president of the United States, not governor of California. William Brennan, who was a Democrat, but Eisenhower
which
appointed
important
him to
note
court,
that
hoping to attract both.
I'm sorry to interrupt. It's important to note that, you know, Dewey's running as the modern Republican, right? And so for, you know, people who aren't familiar with this, I mean, this essentially meant that this was a faction within the Republican Party that thought that the future of the GOP's political fortunes after the New Deal would depend upon essentially making peace with the New Deal and eschewing the old right, which wanted to repeal these things.
Exactly.
Right? And so they, in popular terms, these were known as liberal Republicans.
Sure. And were at the very least, certainly at least moderate Republicans. Certainly,
yeah.
You know, Earl
yeah.
Warren, I don't know if he would ever have thought of himself as liberal, but certainly, you know, Warren in California and Dewey in New York were not opposed to progressive social legislation and whatnot. William Brennan, who was a Democrat from New Jersey, but Eisenhower appointed him to the Supreme Court with an eye towards the 1956 election, hoping to draw upon both Catholic voters and some Democrats. So the four of them were from the beginning in favor of the petition of the Tennessee plaintiffs. They thought something should be done. At the other end, there was certainly Felix Frankfurter was the most obvious and the loudest opponent of getting involved. John Marshall Harlan, who was who had been a New York corporate lawyer and whose grandfather was the first Supreme Court Justice, John Marshall Harlan, who, of course, was the only person to dissent from Plessy versus Ferguson back in the 1890s. He joined Frankfurter. They were very much aligned and sort of opposing any sort of federal intervention, no matter how bad it was. Then you had Tom Clark, who's interesting, who was a Democrat from Texas, who had been Harry Truman's attorney general. And then Charles Whitaker, who we can get into his story a little bit later, who was essentially a Republican lawyer in in Kansas City. Who was not very well known, had sort of rapidly ascended. Eisenhower appointed him first to the district court, then to the appellate court, and then to the Supreme Court in a very short period of time. He'd only been on the court for a couple of years and actually did not even survive Baker v. Carr. He resigned before that case was even handed down. So the four of them were Whitaker actually had a lot of uncertainty in his mind, but initially he sort of sided with the Frankfurter group. And then that left Potter Stewart, who at the time was had been the most recent appointee to the court. He was another Eisenhower appointee, a Republican from Cincinnati, Ohio, had been on the Cincinnati City Council. And Stewart simply couldn't make up his mind. He really was right in the middle. He thought that he understood Frankfurter's concerns, but he also saw that the issues here were so grave that that at the very least, perhaps the federal courts should be allowed to at least step in. So the initial conference vote was 4-4. Stewart said, "I can't decide." So they put it over for re-argument in October of 1961. And as you can imagine, between early May and October, during those 5 months, there was a lot of jockeying going on, especially on the part of Frankfurter, trying to convince Whitaker and Stewart of the rightness of his position. At the end of the day, after some vociferous exchanges and conversations and a great deal of hemming and hawing, after the case was re-argued, Stewart reluctantly agreed that that the plaintiffs ought to be allowed to present their case to the federal courts, that the federal courts did have jurisdiction. But he was very clear that he did not, that he was skeptical that any sort of, that the federal courts could establish any sort of standard that the states would have to meet in a poor. He was really not at all convinced that that the states could, that the courts could get into that issue. But he was willing to acknowledge that there may in fact be an equal protection argument here, that the federal courts should not simply throw the cases out and say we don't have jurisdiction. And that really is the issue. So in Baker, which is ultimately handed down in March of 1962, the federal courts may adjudicate, do have jurisdiction, and can hear reapportionment disputes. And of course, you have William Douglas and others who wanted to go much further. But at the time, it was, you need 5 votes. And so Potter Stewart was clearly the swing vote. Now it gets really interesting and kind of messy in the last couple of weeks right before the decision comes down, because Tom Clark, who all along had given no hint whatsoever that he was anything other than aligned with Frankfurter, sat down at Frankfurter's suggestion to write a dissent on a particular issue. And he said, I simply cannot sustain a logical argument. He said, this doesn't make sense. And so he actually switched his vote. And Clark would have gone ahead, Clark was willing to go ahead and address the issue of standards, which Stewart had not. So in fact, the other four, Douglas and Black and Brennan and Warren, could have in fact, once Clark switched, had said, okay, we're going to go ahead and reach the issue of standards, which would have lost Stewart. So they decided not to get into that. So what they essentially did is in Baker v. Carr, when it comes down, the final vote was actually 6-2, because the week before it came down, Charles Whitaker several weeks before he'd gone into the hospital. He suffered from severe anxiety and depression, and the debates over Baker v. Carr may have been sort of the final straw there. And so he ends up resigning from the court just before as Baker is being announced. And so the final decision was actually 6-2. And then essentially what Baker v. Carr did was open up the federal courts to challenges in every state, just about challenging the actual makeup of the legislature, what standards should be followed. And so the issue over the next 2 years before we get to Reynolds v. Sims and the other state cases in 1964 is really, what is the standard going to be?
Right. Yeah. You make the point. It's not that the Baker Carr is significant in that it tells states what to do, but it opens these doors. And so this gets us to Reynolds Sims. This is Alabama, right? And we have a case where I just wanted to throw this in there. You say there had been 1,000 reapportionment bills introduced in the Alabama state legislature between 1900 and 1960. Not a single one of them passed.
Right. Over there. And as you pointed out earlier, so Alabama was one of the states that literally had not reapportioned in 60 years, I think since 1900 or 1901. And so there were something like 36 cases from different states around the country challenging both legislative and congressional malapportionment. Ultimately, in the 1963-64 year, the court hears 6 of the state cases, cases from Alabama, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, New York, and Colorado, and a congressional reapportionment case from Georgia. And so that's where they really turn towards the issue of standards. Reynolds v. Sims is the one that we usually talk about because that's the case that the court selected as the lead case. as with Brown versus Board of Ed, you know, with Brown versus Board, there were five different state cases, and Brown was the first one that they announced that became the lead case. And so Reynolds v. Sims, which does come from Alabama, became the lead case. And then they then applied the findings in Reynolds to the other cases. One of the points I try to make, and which I found most interesting, is that in many respects, I think actually it's the Colorado case of the six, which is the most important, because Reynolds basically said, the Reynolds case was crucial in that it said that both houses of a legislature must be apportioned according to the principle of one person, one vote. So that was seminal. That was crucial. That was important. That was a big surprise. I don't think even, you know, that many people expected the court to go quite that far. But because things in Alabama had been so bad, if you just looked at Reynolds alone, there's sort of still some the possibility that you might have some wiggle room. You know, does that mean that districts can be, you know, 10, 15, 20% different from others? The Colorado case is very different because Colorado, in the wake of Baker, so in 1962, after Baker v. Carr comes down, Colorado voters went to the polls and they adopted a plan which provided for a one branch of legislature specifically based on population and for a Senate based on a combination of population and geography. So I think it left the Senate something like 35% of the populace could control a majority of the state Senate, whereas it took a real majority to control the lower house. And this was seen as pretty good. You know, not many states had a system quite that good. But in the Colorado case, and the justices were more evenly divided on that one than they were on, you know, the Alabama case and some of the other cases where the malapportionment was so extreme. In the Colorado case, the court essentially was saying that one person, one vote means that, and there's really very, very, very little wiggle room here. There's not, you know, it's not okay to have only 35% of the population electing a majority of the of one branch, even if the other one is based on population. So that was really what I think. If the court had simply, you know, if the court had adopted a standard, just said one branch has to be based on population, the other you can do whatever you want, like with the, you know, with the federal government, there wouldn't have been much opposition. But I think it was the fact that they were so, I think they realized, well, where do you draw the line? And other than going with a straight population standard, it was going to be impossible to draw a line somewhere halfway.
Tell us about the Justice Department. What's their role in all this?
Sure. Well, I think it's certainly, this is one of the fascinating parts of doing the research for this, and that you had, the Kennedy, you know, Kennedy, as I said earlier, as a presidential candidate, had openly committed himself to believing that more better representation, especially for urban populations, was necessary and was right. The Justice Department stepped into the fray and did in fact support the plaintiffs in all of the reapportionment cases. The one place, though, and this provides real sort of some drama behind the scenes drama to the story. The one question there with the Kennedy administration, though, was that you had Archibald Cox, who was the Solicitor General, had come from the Harvard Law School faculty, had once upon a time been a student of Felix Frankfurter's. He was cautious by nature, and I think he believed. Some people have said that, oh, he was just, you know, he was almost like Frankfurter. I don't believe that. I think that Cox was not really Frankfurtian in this regard, but that he believed that the court, that the administration should not push the court too far too fast. I think he underestimated how far the court was willing to go by a long degree. And he even admitted later, you know, several years later after this had all blown over, he acknowledged that his concerns and fears were overblown. You know, he worried that if the court went too far too fast, it would lead to all sorts of unrest and sort of the kind of anti-court sentiment that you had in the wake of the Brown decision. So you do have these sort of some interesting negotiations behind the scenes where you have, you know, Burke Marshall, who is the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Civil Rights Division, and Nicholas Katzenbach, who's the Deputy Attorney General, Robert Kennedy, who's the Attorney General, who all are really ready to, you know, to put the federal government on the side of a strict one person, one vote standard, whereas Archibald Cox wasn't willing to go that far. So the federal government briefs end up being sort of these tortured documents that basically are willing, you know, won't adopt a specific one person, one vote standard, but argue for kind of everything just short of that, and that you have to have, you know, adequate representation, but without really saying how far you can, you know, that you have to go the whole way. But I think it did matter to some of the justices. There's one account where Potter Stewart was actually asked what the Eisenhower administration's position had been. It mattered to him and Baker that the Eisenhower administration, as well as the Kennedy administration, had been supportive of some of these steps. So the Justice Department, I think, in terms of, you know, putting the imprimatur and the force of the federal government behind these decisions, did play an important role. Ultimately, you know, the briefs that they filed, I wouldn't want to say they weren't important to the court, but they ultimately did not guide the court, and the court decided to go for it, essentially, despite the hesitations of the Justice Department.
Well, and this sparks a real fierce reaction, in part because there's some fear. I mean, I wonder how far-reaching you think this fear was, but a fear that this would actually, you know, because the court, that this would extend to the federal level, because the court, right, makes a point of saying this is the federal level, the federal system of unequal representation is exempt, the Senate essentially.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't think that, you know, I think I mentioned earlier that in the last part of the story, when you get to the real backlash, there were people who, you know, were trying to raise the issue of, oh gosh, this is going to threaten the federal, you know, the federal system, you know, the composition of the U.S. Congress. I don't think the Justice Department was really too worried about that, or that there was no real discussion that, you know, that a one person, one vote standard was going to lead. You know, because the U.S. Congress is so clearly the product of a very clearly documented compromise between, you know, smaller states and larger states during the original Constitutional Convention, there was no one credible, I think I would say, who was actually arguing that, you know, the reapportionment decisions were going to threaten that. It was used as a scare tactic later on in trying to reverse the court's decisions.
I mean, that's a this was trying to sort of this gets us to Everett Dirksen and the backlash. Dirksen is the minority leader, GOP representative from Illinois, might one of the badly represented states in the union, and he hires Whitaker Baxter to essentially launch this repeal campaign. I mean, you know, it's sort of odd that you note that for every editorial that celebrated the court for the decision, there was another editorial that lambasted it. The John Birch Society, which of course is not terribly mainstream but was influential enough in the conservative movement, launches this impeach Earl Warren campaign. Dirksen's talking about having the first constitutional convention since 1789. And they're talking about stripping the court of certain powers. Tell us about that. Maybe we should sort of
Sure.
go out talking about that
Yeah.
and why that fails.
Sure, absolutely. So June of 1964 is when the Supreme Court hands down the state the decisions in the state reapportionment cases, saying that, you know, all state legislatures have to ascribe to a, you know, a principle of one person, one vote. And the reaction is immediate. I mean, you have, I think, within days or something, like more than 100 bills in Congress are introduced. And some of the, you know, the most far-reaching ones are, not coincidentally, you know, which many of which are sponsored by, you know, Strom Thurmond and some of the most strident white supremacists in Congress, you know, want to strip the Supreme Court of all jurisdiction relating to reapportionment. There's others, you know, there was other measures to try to create like a super court of the union, which would include the chief justices of all the state Supreme Courts that could override the Supreme Court. And so there really was this, you know, this very whole wide range of bills, and you know, all aimed at sort of at undermining the court in the wake of the reapportionment decisions. As things settle a little bit, Everett Dirksen emerges as kind of the leader of the anti-reapportionment forces. And as you mentioned, Illinois provides just this wonderful example because the two senators from Illinois at the time were Everett Dirksen and Paul Douglas. Paul Douglas is from Chicago. He's a liberal Democrat, you know, right down the line, one of the most liberal members of the United States Senate. Ironically, you know, he was a former professor who had actually written about reapportionment. Everett Dirksen is from an, you know, old family of German immigrants who settled in central Illinois. You know, he's from the town of Pekin, which is outside Peoria. I mean, if you could, you couldn't come up with, you know, more sort of classic middle America product than Everett Dirksen. And so they, in many ways, I think, come to represent the two sides of this debate, the sort of the more urban base and the more, not so much rural, but small town America. And, you know, for Dirksen and his supporters, but what's interesting about Dirksen is that, you know, yes, he's from small town America, but he's got really strong ties and connections with the Chamber of Commerce, with the manufacturers associations, with the really large business groups. We haven't really talked about this yet, but it's as much urban based business interests who like the way, you know,
right,
prefer the rural dominated legislature because it, they keep taxes low, they are less inclined to pass labor, you know, pro-labor legislation, that sort of thing. So Dirksen's initial attempt, what he does first is to try to push a constitutional amendment through the U.S. Senate. Of course, it requires two-thirds of the votes to do that. And consistently, they actually tried three separate times over the next 3 years, and they consistently got 50s, I think 58, 59, maybe as many as 60 votes, but never quite the two-thirds necessary to send it to the states for ratification. And ultimately, what they settled on was a bill that would have allowed essentially for the federal system at the state level. So some of the earlier, more extreme bills, you know, got tossed by the wayside over time. But you had this really kind of unique and very ironic situation in September 64, August and September 64, where it's actually liberal Democrats who launch what was referred to in the press as a little filibuster to slow down action on the Dirksen Amendment, whereas it was only just several months before that Dirksen had actually led the vote to end the Southern filibuster against the civil rights movement. So you
right.
do have actually a sort of a little filibuster involved in sort of postponing a vote. Ultimately, the Dirksen Amendment does not get the two-thirds votes. It's brought back up in subsequent years, and the vote doesn't ever really change in that regard. But in the meantime, as you say, Dirksen hires Whitaker and Baxter, and by now Clem Whitaker has died and his wife, Leota Baxter, has retired. But his son, her stepson, Clem Whitaker Jr., now runs the firm. And so they oversee a national campaign to call a constitutional convention, which in theory would have had the power to modify the Supreme Court decision to put in place what the Dirksen Amendment had envisioned. So in the span of 5 years, from 1964 to 69, there are actually 33 state legislatures petitioned Congress to call a constitutional convention. Now, it only would have required, theoretically, 34 states to do that. This has never been done. There is a clause in the Constitution that says, you know, there are two ways to amend the Constitution. Congress can pass an amendment and send it to the states, or the states can call for a convention. Of course, this has never happened. It was somewhat dramatic, although it plays out over 5 years. And you know, when it was in the 20s and even up to the high 20s, no one was really paying much attention. Once you get up to 32 states, and then, of course, in the spring of 1969, when Iowa becomes the 33rd state, people really start asking questions, and there were proponents of reapportionment who started saying, well, not all these petitions are valid because some of them were passed by malapportioned legislatures. In order to be valid, you'd have to reapportion the legislature, then pass a petition, which led to this sort of mouthwatering possibility that the Supreme Court would end up having to decide on the legitimacy of some of these petitions. But it never got that far. Others, including Dirksen, were actually behind the scenes, you know, very clear that they did not want a constitutional convention to have, and they thought that the threat of a constitutional convention would be enough to get Congress to pass, you know, the Senate to pass an amendment, so that they would avoid. Because, of course, you know, then the people start talking about, well, constitutional convention, well, you can't limit a constitutional convention to only one issue. The entire Constitution
right.
is up for grabs. we don't really know because we've never had one since the original one. But there was this really fascinating series of issues at play in terms of, well, you know, not only which petitions are legitimate and which aren't, but what would a constitutional convention actually look like and who would decide and et cetera, et cetera. And then in the early fall, right around early September of 1969, actually Everett Dirksen died from cancer, and already by then a number of states had begun to reapportion, and a few states even talked about rescinding their petitions, and so the movement towards the convention actually sort of essentially died with Everett Dirksen in many respects. But it was a quite a remarkable backlash that took place, again, sort of in the undercurrent of, you know, behind the scenes of the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War movement, you know, anti-war movement, things which were much more likely to make the news. This was going on.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to take us out by ending on a downer, but there's two sort of at least two things you can add to the list that I took it from the end is that, you know, for well, maybe sort of accepting the South and the importance of this to Jim Crow, the cities, especially the northern cities where most of the population had been for so long, had really labored or been cheated by, you know, underserviced and underrepresented by the system. But the sort of tragic irony for them is that no one sort of really seems to get that the country is rapidly suburbanized. And so the real winners end up being the suburbs when we reapportion. And so the policy outcomes sort of follow the sort of weird hybrid politics of the suburbs. And then the folks at the congressional level who are affected by this, you know, you know, scholars who have talked about how this is the background for gerrymandering.
I mean, you're absolutely right about both those points. So on the first point, yes, it is sort of a real irony that and Earl Warren even acknowledged this in an interview in the mid 1960s, that he recognized that, you know, to have brought the kind of level of change to urban policy that really would have benefited the cities, these decisions would have been handed down in the 1920s or 30s. That by the 1960s, it was in many ways too late to really address the most serious urban problems. I think for Warren, though, there was, you know, while tragic that might be, there was a principle involved here, and it didn't matter, you know, for him on one level, it didn't matter who actually ends up benefiting most. That principle was sacred, and the notion that everybody's vote would be counted the same was paramount. Although he did, as I said, recognize kind of the tragic irony there. On gerrymandering, you know, it's gerrymandering existed long before these decisions. Of course, you know, the term itself comes from the early 1800s and a district, you know, the districting in Massachusetts. So certainly gerrymandering existed at the time, and the court was very aware. I actually had a long, really interesting conversation with Earl Warren's law clerk about this, who essentially drafted the Reynolds opinions. You know, that they knew that gerrymandering was an issue. You know, the New York Times referred to gerrymandering as the twin evil of malapportionment, and so they weren't naive in thinking that, you know, this was going to, that the reapportionment decisions were going to get rid of gerrymandering. But I think they felt that at the time that the malapportionment was the more serious issue, that it affected more people. You know, gerrymandering existed, but it wasn't as necessary if you could simply draw districts with vastly different numbers of people in them. You didn't have to make up crazy lines. And so they felt that this was, you know, that in many respects this had to be tackled first, and then gerrymandering, you know, would perhaps be next or down the road. Of course, we're in a situation now where, you know, gerrymandering has become increasingly sophisticated, and with, you know, computer programming, it's really sophisticated. And then you have a Supreme Court now where five members have consistently said that, you know, gerrymandering for political reasons is okay. You know, the court in Gamillion versus Lightfoot in 1960 said racial gerrymandering is not okay, but political gerrymandering remains okay. You know, and until Anthony Kennedy or his successor decides to change their mind, and you, and I try to make the point I think we tend to underestimate the importance of the malapportionment decisions because you do, you know, have gerrymandering and other things that are in place now. But that if you, you know, if you were to get a fifth justice to change their mind, you know, any sort of decision now striking down political gerrymandering would be every bit as remarkable and revolutionary as what the court did with Reynolds and the reapportionment decisions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I can't help but think that this is related. I was, you know, doing my own research on this, related to the subject. I mean, I came across Greg Coker's book on filibustering, and you know, if you chart this historically as well, it's right around this time period that the filibuster becomes, you know, the numbers just go up and up and up.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, at the federal level, the minority has found, the popular minority has found ways to obstruct.
Yeah.
And in the same sort of vein.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so I've taken a lot of your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
There's a traditional question we ask here, and that's, what are you working on next?
Well, that's a great question. I have not yet fully committed to it, but I'm increasingly inclined to think that Whitaker and Baxter, who we talked about before, I think deserve a much closer look, not specifically as a biography, but as sort of the founders of what has become modern day political campaign consulting and management. I just think there's so much there, and they provide a really interesting personal story to go along with what is a really, I think, critical public policy story. So I'm edging closer and closer towards launching into a book on Whitaker and Baxter.
I would enjoy reading that. Well, Doug, thanks so much for joining us today. It's a great book. All the best with it.
Well,
and I hope we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.